find our snack bar chock full of good things to eat and drink. Tasty, tempting hot dogs, thirst-quenching soft drinks, fresh, crunchy popcorn. You've plenty of time, so visit the snack bar now.
The apocalyptic vision of a criminally insane, charismatic cult leader.
Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. You're the man who would not take it anymore. Who would not let... Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. You're the man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the cunts, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is someone who stood up.
All I know is this violates every canon of respectable broadcasting.
You have meddled with the primal forces of nature! And you will atone!
We have to strike now, sir! Annihilate! Kill! Kill! Annihilate! Kill! Kill! Annihilate! Kill! Kill!
After very careful consideration, sir, I've come to the conclusion that your new defense system sucks.
I'm as mad as hell! They are not very dangerous anymore!
Welcome to the show, all you old listeners and you new people that are just trying out for the first or second time. This is Infonomicon, and I am your host, Droops. Now, we don't often use, or at least read, email on the show, but I'm going to read a little bit of it. A fella by the name of Polymyra wrote in after listening to the Iron Geek episodes, and he says, "Hey, Droops and company. I was just listening to episode 33, and I noticed that during your rundown of the different live CDs, Auditor, Flag, Nopix, STD, etc., the one, and best in my opinion, that you didn't mention would be Wapix, White Hat Nopix, which is a great pen-testing Nopix spinoff. It's got a beautiful interface, well-organized, and even has hundreds of exploits built in with easy-to-use Perl search scripts. Thought you might want to check it out. And maybe mention it on the show." All right, that's Wapix at www.wapix.net. Everybody go check it out. I also got an email from some fella I met at Nauticon. He said he learned about our show from listening to BenRev Radio, listened to a couple episodes on the plane yesterday, found them enjoyable, and look forward to more. Keep up the good work. Hell yeah. InUser sent one in to me. He says, "Hey there, I just heard episode 34. It's good stuff, man. I've known about the history of radio, but the spin you put on the story was excellent. It was probably one of my favorite episodes." Well, it was one of my favorite episodes also. And this next episode, the one that's happening right now, is kind of similar. There's this book I just read by David Bodanis. It's called Electric Universe. It's frickin' awesome. Actually, it's not frickin' awesome. It's motherfuckin' awesome. And, you're thinking, whoa, this guy likes math, but no, I don't like math. It's the history of electricity without all the math. It's what people were thinking, you know, thought process, how they lived kind of things, when they came up with all this electricity mess, and how they acted as real people. So instead of thinking Samuel Morse, he invented Morse code, you think Samuel Morse, lying, cheating, stealing son of a bitch who was fucking loony in the head. And I've actually been given permission by the author to read a chapter of his book. Maybe he's never heard of Infonomicon, but I'm going to read it. I'm not going to mess anything up. Some things I'm going to use a little more emphasis, but I hope you enjoy it. And if you do enjoy it, go to your local library, go to your college library, and say, "Hey, librarian, buy this book." And the librarian will buy the book. And then you read it. And then you put it back on the shelf. And then other people read it. And it gets around. It didn't cost you anything. I'm not into selling stuff. But you'll definitely enjoy it. Just keep listening. Things I like about this book. It tells the history of electricity. And it's not some boring shit you learn in school. like, blah, 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 here's some math, blah, 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 here's some math. It's kind of gossipy. It's kind of what the people were thinking when things came about. And whether it's completely true or not, maybe it's a lot of made-up stuff, it's a good story. And it's definitely something that you should all read. Anyway, this first chapter is called The Frontiersman and the Dandy. Joseph Henry was a strapping, raw-boned American from the distant reaches of the frontier state of New York, who by the age of 30 had left jobs as a handyman, too boring, a builder, too low paid, a metal worker, too hot, and then, most disastrously, a surveyor, where he let himself be talked into leading a crew for several winter months throughout the forest toward the Canadian border. Far, far too cold. In 1826, freshly back from the surveying and miraculously undamaged by frostbite, he heard about a position at a school in his native town of Albany. The salary would be low, and as a new hire, Henry would be stuck with teaching elementary arithmetic, along with other topics. But the classrooms would be warm, so he nabbed the new job in an instant. He had dozens of farm boys to keep quiet, boys expert at spitballs and pencil jabs. But he knew what would keep them happy. Boys like building stuff. The bigger, the better. He'd give them something really, really big to build. The new field of electricity would be a good place to hunt for an idea, he decided, for it was an area he'd long been intrigued in a casual, self-educated way. The word covered a whole range of effects, from small sparks of static to giant lightning bolts investigated famously by Philadelphia's best-known retired printer, Benjamin Franklin. It was interesting stuff, for it always seemed to involve a strange sort of sparking substance. No one knew much more about what it actually was, though, but Henry had just heard an intriguing hint. Not many European science journalists made it to Albany, but one that did, months late, after the usual long ocean voyage and the wait for the ice on the Hudson to melt, described the extraordinary experiment of a recently demobilized British artillery officer, William Sturgeon. When Sturgeon had taken a piece of iron and wrapped a coil of wire around it, nothing much happened. This was fair enough. But then he'd gone on and connected the wire to a battery, so that Volta's mysterious electric current sparked through the wire. The ordinary iron had seemed to come alive. It had turned into a strong magnet that pulled other pieces of iron toward itself, as if an invisible force were jumping from the wire into the iron. Switch off the battery, everything stopped. The original lump of iron became inert, and what it had lifted toward itself fell off. It was no longer magnetized. Sturgeon didn't know what to make of this discovery, but Henry knew exactly what to do with it. His boys were suffering from general winter's restlessness, and this amazing toy is what he could use to keep their attention. The boys were good with their hands, and liked solid physical things, as their parents did too. Most of the wooden houses in Albany were newly built, and it was often the settlers themselves who had done the building. If he could make the electrical magnet really huge, he'd have them all on his side. Creating one of Volta's batteries to power the whole contraption wasn't too hard, for there was plenty of metal ore available, either locally or from the big ports to the east. Henry was a fast worker, and by 1827 he had duplicated Sturgeon's work, creating an electromagnet that could lift 9 pounds. The boys in his classroom wrapped still more coils of wire around the lump of iron. The battery switched on, the wrapped chunk of iron could now lift more than 20 pounds. Henry did yet more wrapping, and when the coils of wire got so close together that they touched and started crackling, he simply asked his new bride for her petticoats, enlisted her to help cut them into strips, and use the cloth to insulate the copper wires, so they could be wrapped even more tightly together. By 1830, there, on the edge of the American frontier, he had succeeded in building a small electromagnet that could lift 750 pounds. The school kids loved it, no doubt, asked some of their friends, still out on the farms, to come help watch this marvel. Henry was proud of it too, but for a deeper reason. He was a deeply religious man and had always suspected that God had created marvels not visible to ordinary eyes. With enough ingenuity, though, we could magnify and reveal God's hidden work. Henry kept on going. Before he was done, he had wrapped a small chunk of iron so tightly with wire that when the battery was switched on, that small chunk lifted more than 1,500 pounds. the weight of several big blacksmith's anvils. Just so everyone could see, he hoisted the whole thing up on a sturdy scaffolding, disconnect the battery, and with an almighty crash that never fails to produce a great sensation, Henry wrote, all that weight would come plummeling down. Now, there are times when it pays to worry about underlying explanations, and there are other times when good, honest tinkering is the best way forward. Future researchers would learn that the atoms aren't made of solid little ball bearings, and that parts of them are electrically charged and can be torn off. Those torn-off bits are called electrons, and researchers, by the end of the 1800s, came to believe that they were what rolled forward inside the wire. And it was the power of those charged electrons that gave the electric current its strength. When an electric cable gets cut open in a storm, the sparks that spray out are a sign of streams of electrons that were inside the cable. Within a phone wire, electrons are rolling forward, and inside a powerful searchlight, even more electrons are moving. Henry himself would become a big part of research leading up to those findings. In years to come, he became recognized as one of the greatest American physicists of the 19th century, ending up as director of the Smithsonian. But at this point, fairly young and still stuck in Albany, he knew he wasn't going to arrive at much of an explanation with all the lifting and banging his electromagnets could produce. Instead, he invented the telegraph. It was easy enough. He just lengthened the wire that stretched from his battery to the electromagnet. The electrons that poured from the metals in the battery were powerful enough to seemingly hurtle themselves along. Rather than keep the battery right next to the electromagnet when he turned it on, he could carry it to the next room, or down the hall, or even downstairs. The mysterious electric force would squirt along from the battery, through the wire, and turn on the electromagnet, waiting at the end of the wire. Any lump of iron next to it would be tugged close. It would have been pretty glumpy telegraph if it had to lift up and drop giant chunks of metal every time he wanted to send a single letter of the alphabet. Instead, Henry went back to using tiny electromagnets, even slimmer than the ones the British officer had created. Right next to it, he put something resembling a small, clickable cassinet, like a little metal tongue. Turn on the battery, the current ran down the wire, the electromagnet powered up, and it pulled the cassinet toward itself. You heard a click. Turn off the battery, and the electromagnet let go. You heard another click as the cassinet went back. Henry realized it would be easy to communicate just by agreeing that different arrangements of clicks would represent different letters. The electric charges would have been dormant so long, and the ancient metals was now coming out to power this click. The Albany schoolboys loved the new invention, especially when Henry let them get rid of the cassinet and use a ringer of a bell instead. When one of the kids switched the battery on and off, his friends in the next room or even down the hall would hear the ringer sound in short bursts, as fast as his hand could move. At this point, a very different sort of individual entered the field, someone who would have his own ideas about how these electric discoveries could be used. Samuel Morse had studied fine art at Phillips and Yale. In his early 20s, he was living off his parents' money in London. He seemed to be just another art student, explaining in one of his many letters home that he was asking for more money, not because of his difficulties in painting a portrait that actually looked like any of his sitters, but rather because, and one has to be honest, here, he was too good for even the refined British to recognize. And I quote, "Had I no higher thoughts than being a first-rate portrait painter," he explained to his mother, "I would have chosen a far different profession. My ambition is to be among those who shall revive the splendor of the 15th century, to rival the genius of Raphael, a Michelangelo, or a Titan." But underneath that genteel prose, Morse was raving. His father, an evangelical Calvinist, had brought him up to believe that America was being destroyed by secret conspiracies, and when Morse returned to America, he found he still couldn't make a living. He took his father's ideas and went further. The awful powers that were attacking America and keeping deserving artists from commercial success were ones he alone had now identified. There were the Negroes and the Jews and the other undesirables, of course. But behind them all were the Catholics. And behind them were the Jesuits. Secret, armed Jesuits fanning out from their missions across the United States, storing guns in Irish nunneries, and all under the control of the Emperor of Austria. When his pamphlets were ignored, he took it as a further sign of the conspiracy. So in 1836, Moores ran for the mayor of New York with a straightforward slogan to persecute Catholics. "We have to resist the momentous evil that threatens us," he wrote. "Will you not awake to the reality of your danger? Up, up, I beseech you, to your posts!" He lost, of course, and he started sulking, and then holed up in an isolated area in one of the highest buildings overlooking the recently founded New York University. He worked out what needed to be done. The Jesuits were controlling America through invisible forces, so it was necessary that Moores, and all other good Americans, develop a similar means of fighting back. Something that could stretch everywhere and flash information along the speed of electricity would just be about ideal. Luckily, on a ship voyage from London not long before, he had overheard one passenger discuss some of the ways electricity was being used for such long-distance contacts. It was pretty well known Joseph Henry was teaching at the College of New Jersey, soon to be renamed Princeton University, and by then, some news of his work had been published, and there also had been similar trials in Europe. Charles Whetstone, William Cook in England, for example, had stretched a wire from the train terminal in Euston in London to a train depot at a strange round building in Camden over a mile away. When they connected the Euston end of the wire to the battery, an electromagnet in the Camden area got switched on. The local residents loved it, for the single telegraph wire replaced the piercing whistle and whappingly loud drums that had been used to communicate arrivals and departures before. Now in this New York retreat, after struggling to make a telegraph of his own work efficiently, he suffered from a great lack of abilities as in his mechanical tinkering as his artistic efforts. Moores almost gave up in frustration. He was certain that there had to be an easier way, so he decided to get help from someone who actually knew what these mysterious electrical substances operated and could explain it to him. Which is how, probably a spring day in 1838, Joseph Henry found a surprisingly impassioned ex-painter at the door of his Princeton office. Now, Henry was as easygoing at Princeton as he had been in Albany. The students liked him. By now, he was stretching telegraph cables for more than a mile around the Princeton campus, and students regularly helped him in the work. Henry had often declared that patents were the sort of thing that had held Europe back. Okay, this is 1830-something? Henry had often declared that patents were the sort of thing that held Europe back. He happily explained to Moores how his system worked. The batteries and the electromagnet were the spools of wire. In America, a young and growing country, it was right and proper, Henry believed, for all good citizens to share what they had learned. When Moores left Princeton, he knew what was best for one good citizen, at least. He'd always been keen to patent anything he could. While still an artist, he'd struggled with an impractical marble carving device, and he patented the information he'd picked up from Henry's work, as well as techniques he'd learned from reading European reports. The idea of using simple code for telegraph was already surprisingly widespread. The great German mathematician Carl Friedrich Gauss, who'd strung a telegraph along his Groton campus in 1833, had set up his receiving electromagnet to tug a needle either to the left or the right. If it shifted to the right, that could mean a letter, such as E was intended. If it shifted to the left, that could mean the letter A. Two shifts to the right signify an I, while other combinations of left and right signified other letters, all the way to the least common letters, such as X and Z. Other researchers regularly came up with simpler codes, for it made sense to have the simplest signal stand for the most common letters, the most complex signal stand for the rare letters. It was possible to find which letters were most common by simply going to a print shop and looking. Typesetters tended to accumulate big boxes of type bearing the letter E, since they had to use them more often. They had only smaller boxes for the rarely demanded Q, X, and Z. Now, it took Moore several years and judicious financial involvement with key members of Congress before he secured enough government funds to actually build a large working prototype of his telegraph device. In its first week of commercial operation in 1844, connected Washington with Baltimore. It took in just 13.5 cents in paid traffic, but in the next year, an expanded line was taking in over $100 each week, and within a decade, Moores was one of the wealthier men in North America. Did it matter he had largely stolen the idea of his invention? Telegraphs were already operating in England and in Germany and in America. Other inventors were close behind him. Someone else would no doubt have helped jumpstart the American system if Moores hadn't done it. Though Divine justice didn't keep Moores from earthly riches. It did strike in another way. Joseph Henry had a satisfying life, at ease with his students and respected by his peers. Moores, however, having engaged in so much subterfuge, spent most of the next three decades stuck in litigation trying to defend the patents he'd railroaded through in his name. There was an embarrassing moment when his lawyer was forced to announce to the Supreme Court that a notebook, which honestly, truly had Moores's original handwritten notes on the telegraph, had mysteriously disappeared in a fire, to which there were no witnesses, shortly before it was supposed to be shown in the court. The invention had other unexpected consequences as well. Before the telegraph, a horseman carrying a message between two cities had to transport the bulk of perhaps 1,000 pounds of animal over rock, muddy ruts, and the occasional fallen tree. That took plenty of food for the two mammals involved, as well as the bulky technologies of saddle, stables, horseshoes, and the like. With a few exceptions, information at the start of the 19th century traveled at about the same rate as it managed in ancient Sumner. A thin copper telegraph wire, however, carrying the same message, merely had to move an electric current composed of those mysterious sparks. No one in Henry's day knew that those sparks had something to do with electrons, which weigh less than a millionth of an ounce each. But his contemporaries did realize, while what was in the wire was smaller and moved a lot faster than anything in the ordinary world, a battery small enough to fit in a thimble could power a message great distances at great speeds. The world changed. Financial news could now be sent instantly between cities, and along with enhanced opportunities for insider trading, a new style of corporations arose. Officers in far distant cities could be easily linked. Train networks became more complex, for telegraphs strung beside the rail lines could synchronize departures and arrivals across entire countries. There were psychological shifts as well. Before electricity became widespread, time had been something local, changeable, personal. New York and Baltimore, for example, had kept their clock systems several minutes apart, since they were at slightly different longitudes, and noon arrived a few minutes later in Baltimore than it did in New York. Each city was a separate world, and it was fair to think that each individual, strolling here or there, working on this, that isolated farm, was part of a similarly separate world. But now those worlds could be synchronized, and wherever you were, you knew where you fit in the universal control of clock time. It was an early form of globalization. As the telegraph spread into Central and Eastern Europe, millions of peasants were forced to take on last names, the better for the newly enlarged government bureaucracies to educate, tax, or enlist them. In the past, the quick movement of mass armies had been possible only through occasional genius of Napoleon or by the temporary enthusiasm of revolutionary citizens. By the mid-1800s, however, tens of thousands of bewildered military recruits regularly found that their marches or train transport, synchronized by telegraph, delivered them as close as possible to where thousands of armed enemy soldiers were unfortunately similarly being assembled. Newspapers stopped being journals of slow discussion or courtly gossip and started depending on featured foreign correspondents. Diplomatic crises had less time to calm down, as Foreign Office lassitude was regularly broken by urgent, just-arrived messages. Mass political movement sprang up faster than before. New factory techniques spread more quickly as well. One more consequence. Even more jobs were available in America, and with this telegraph-aided globalization, increasing numbers of Europeans were able to make arrangements to move there. New steamship lines appeared to bring the workers over, first by the thousands, then by the tens of thousands. There were Jews and Protestants, but there were also Catholics, lots of them, bursting with energy. The result was a dynamic, immigrant-rich America. It was everything that Joseph Henry loved, and it was everything that Samuel Moores hated. Well, anyway, that was Electric Universe by David Badonis. Excellent, excellent book. Go get it at your local library or get them to get it. Now, while y'all were listening to that, did y'all hear Microsoft? Did y'all hear open source? Did you hear people bitching about patents in Europe 200 years ago almost? Yeah. Same shit, different day. Learn your history. If you don't learn it, you're going to be doomed to repeat it. Anyway, I didn't really plan much else for the show. I expected it to go a little longer than this. So I'm going to close with a Grateful Dead song. And if you're wondering why I'm playing all this Grateful Dead, well, one, I really like it. And two, you can go to archive.org and download all kinds of live show music, including The Grateful Dead. And this is a song that I don't even know which ones I've already played, but I really, really, really like this one a lot. It's called Box of Rain. Maybe you won't enjoy it as much as the book, but song kicks ass. So, anyway, I've been Droops, and I'm Mickey Finn.
You can see clear to me.